Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for Thursday, October 27th, 2022. Final signatures for Presidio International Bridge construction expected by Monday. By Sam Karras, October 26th, 2022. Presidio. At Wednesday's meeting, Presidio County Commissioners received a promising update on the unfinished Presidio International Bridge, according to a contract specialist previously employed by the state agency overseeing the project. The cross-border legal agreement holding up the repairs could be on Governor Abbott's desk by next week. The project to expand the bridge was conceived 12 years ago, but has been plagued with delays and broken promises over the past four, leaving locals concerned about long wait times in customs and, in the long term, about the ability of Presidio's port economy to grow. The latest update leads local officials to believe the long wait could soon be over. Blanco Serrano, a former contract specialist with the Texas Department of Transportation, TxDOT, who has been involved in the Presidio Bridge project since its inception, gave commissioners an update through her work with the agency at her new private sector position. Serrano felt personally invested in the project, so much so that she delayed her retirement to try to see the project through to its completion. "I felt like I had to finish it no matter what," she said. "Each step of the bridge expansion project is complex because it represents a collaboration between multiple agencies on both sides of the border. Bridge construction is completed in spans, or pieces of the bridge, that must be completed before construction of another can begin. Because of where the actual international border is located, marked by a bronze plaque on the bridge, the United States is responsible for roughly 75% of the bridge construction, which officially kicked off in the spring of 2018 and started to stall a year later. It took officials on the Mexican side until 2020 to get the funding for their spans, but once the money was secured, their construction was completed in 8 months. Meanwhile, the half-finished American side of the bridge was left unfinished. Commissioners last heard a presentation on the bridge back in July, in which they were also promised that construction would begin soon. Local officials were initially told in the spring that the holdup was thanks to the governor's office. A memorandum of understanding that required his signature languished on his desk for 4 years. Abbott's office has not returned repeated requests for comment on this issue. The governor took so long that some officials who had signed the Memorandum of Understanding, MOU, on the Mexican side were no longer in office when the agreement was finally complete. The document had to be redrafted, but Serrano explained that the new MOU was being overnighted to officials representing SICT and CAPUFE, the two Mexican agencies overseeing bridge construction. If all goes according to plan, the MOU will be back on the governor's desk for signatures on Monday. Precinct 3 Commissioner Eloy Aranda was skeptical that the process would be simple, given the governor's track record. "Is the governor on board to sign those papers as soon as he gets them?" he asked. Serrano indicated he was. Once re-initiated, The construction is only expected to take 3 months to complete, which will hopefully take place in early 2023. Local officials had originally hoped that the construction would be complete before the Dia de los Muertos, Thanksgiving and Christmas holidays, which see record-high wait times on the bridge. It's too bad things can't be wrapped up before the holidays start, said County Judge Cinderella Guevara. County and port officials have a tentatively scheduled meeting with the contractor, Earth Builders, out of Hearst, Texas, on November 7th. One of the main problems the contractor will face is evaluating the status of all the materials that were left on the bridge when construction stalled. Many of them will have to be replaced because of how much they've deteriorated over the past few years. Serrano expressed optimism about the contractor's ability to pick up where they left off. "They've been very, very patient with us," she said. Photo courtesy of Leslie Villarreal. Juni Villarreal dresses up in his persona as Miguel Myers, a spoof on the infamous fictional serial killer Michael Myers, for a series of humorous photographs by wife Leslie Villarreal that capture the slayer at local haunts around Marfa. 2022 elections see few campaign finance filings among local contenders. By Sam Karras. Sam at BigBendSentinel.com. Presidio County. As Election Day looms, many Texans are following the money, campaign money to be exact. Candidates at the local, state, and federal level are required to file regular reports of campaign donations and expenditures in the interest of transparency. These laws also apply in tiny Presidio County, where at press time, only two candidates in contested races had filed the appropriate paperwork ahead of November's election. The Texas Ethics Commission, a bipartisan council that oversees laws concerning campaign finance and registering lobbyists, among many other duties, makes the distinction between local and statewide offices. Statewide candidates must file formally with the TEC. Local candidates, like those running for office in Presidio County, report directly to the county clerk. All candidates in Texas must first appoint a campaign treasurer, even if they don't intend to raise or spend any money. Candidates are allowed to be their own treasurer. What happens next depends on how much money candidates expect to raise. $940 is the magic number. Below that dollar amount, candidates only need to file one report. If candidates expect to, or end up, raising more than $940, a different set of rules applies. The exact schedule for filing finance reports depends on when a campaign treasurer is appointed, but generally speaking, candidates with opponents must file two semi-annual reports and two reports before each uniform election date, due 30 and 8 days before each respective election. Precinct 4 Commissioner candidate David Beebe, who reported $3,897.75 in contributions, filed on the 30 days prior deadline. Incumbent candidate for treasurer Francis Garcia, who reported zero contributions and $324 in expenditures, filed an 8-day prior report. This election cycle, Beebe and Garcia were the only two candidates to file reports at all. County Clerk Florcita Zubia explained that that's not out of the norm. Zubia is on the ballot herself this November. She's running unopposed for her current position and serves as the treasurer for her own campaign. "I bought like 2 yard signs and I paid for them out of my pocket," she said. "Nobody has ever made a big deal about campaign finance reports not being turned in." That may change this year, as a hotly contested judicial race drew concerns about out-of-county money, giving certain candidates a boost. Incumbent candidate for county judge Cinderella Guevara received a contribution of $1,361 in yard signs from a conservative PAC called Project Red TX. She told the Big Bend Sentinel she planned to report the money, but hadn't yet filed a report at press time. Guevara indicated that filing the necessary reports and campaigning on top of carrying out the duties of county judge was difficult. There was also an important transition in her staff. Guevara welcomed a new assistant, Ceci Bejarano, earlier this year. "There's a lot of projects going on in the county that you're constantly busy with," she explained. Guevara's opponent, Joe Portillo, had not yet filed a report either. "It's just a handful of people who have contributed to my campaign. They all have roots in Presidio, or they own property here," he explained. "I don't have a big checkbook." Portillo's biggest individual donation, a $5,000 check from Cibolo Creek Ranch's John Poindexter, exceeds the $940 threshold for more lax accounting. Compared to statewide races, Poindexter's and Project Red's contributions toward local judicial campaigns are chump change. Pipeline magnate Kelsey Warren, benefactor of the Lajitas Resort, donated $1 million to Greg Abbott's gubernatorial campaign last year. Warren is just one of 39 individuals who have made contributions of $1 million or more to Abbott since he first ran for statewide office in 1995. Beebe, whose relatively small dollar county commissioner campaign finance report is 33 pages long, explained that the stakes are low for local candidates. "Unless a whistleblower files a formal complaint with the TEC, omissions or representations at the local level aren't likely to garner penalties or even a second glance. No one ever goes to jail for this stuff," he said. "It all just sits in a folder in the county clerk's office." Beebe's own motivation for filing a finance report came from experience. Through his years in city and county government, he'd seen lots of drama driven by speculation about campaign donations, and because most campaigns weren't self-reported, the gossip couldn't be proven true or false. Early in his political career, while running for Marfa City Council, he decided to run without accepting donations. When he left the city and decided to run for county-level positions, he changed his tune. In his first term as Justice of the Peace, he only accepted donations from within the county, but quickly realized that wasn't the best way to beat the rumor mill. "I started only accepting donations from outside the area. None of those people have business in front of the JP," he explained. Compared to other down-ticket campaigns, Beebe raised some serious cash, but not all of it went to his own campaign. His campaign made donations to larger statewide candidates like Beto O'Rourke for governor and Luke Warford for railroad commissioner. All of these contributions are documented in the report. If you're dealing with any money of any significance, you need to go ahead and file, he said. He conceded that the process, especially for first-timers, wasn't self-explanatory. Candidates must keep separate bank accounts for their war chests, and the requirements for what needs to be reported is exhaustive. One particularly finicky example: if you put a campaign expense on a credit card, The interest you pay on that expense to the credit card company must be separately itemized and reported. The process is also complicated on the party level. Unlike county-level candidates, county-level political parties report directly to the TEC, which comes with greater oversight and penalties for miscalculations. The threshold is a bit more generous. Jason Ballman, communications director for the Presidio County Democrats, explained that the party could take in up to $34,220 in contributions before having to appoint a treasurer and report more frequently than once a year. He also clarified that the party can advise its candidates up to a point, but ultimately wasn't responsible for individual candidates' lax accounting practices. "We are really there to be a source of advice and guidance, though we do not, for moral, ethical, and legal reasons, run candidates' campaigns directly," he said. The Democratic Party, on a state and national level, has been looking for a way for their candidates to be able to raise and report money more transparently. Online donations are an attractive solution because political parties and campaigns in Texas cannot accept anonymous donations. Presidio County Democrats were one of the first local organizations to set up an Act Blue account, which allows candidates to accept contributions from anyone residing in the United States over the Internet with a corresponding electronic paper trail. Ballman felt that the extra focus on this year's races was no accident and that getting folks energized about the political process would hopefully lead to more enthusiastic and transparent campaigns. "We're here to represent the people of Presidio County," he said. "We want to make sure that we're doing it really well and we're doing it right." Marfa residents cast ballots during early voting ahead of the November 8th general election. By Mary Cantrell, MKCANTRELL at BigBendSentinel.com. Presidio County. A modest but steady stream of local voters visited the USO building in Marfa this Monday, the first day of early voting for the November 8th general election, to cast their ballots in critical statewide and local races. The ballot this fall includes the gubernatorial race between incumbent Greg Abbott and Democratic challenger Beto O'Rourke, but Presidio County residents will also choose their next county judge, county commissioner, and county treasurer. "I do think that there's going to be more traffic and voting just because we have local races," said County Clerk Florcita Subia of this election cycle. "We're barely getting over COVID where people are comfortable going to the polling location and actually voting." Early voting runs now through Friday, November 4th. Early voting and election day schedules, polling locations, and an overview of local races taking place across the Tri-County area can be found in this week's edition of the Big Bend Sentinel. In Presidio County, 4,394 citizens are currently registered to vote, according to the Tax Assessor Collector's Office, out of a total of 6,131 county residents, according to the 2020 census. A total of 323 people voted in Presidio County this week, on Monday and Tuesday. In Presidio County, voters are given the opportunity to choose between paper and electronic ballots. Sample ballots for review ahead of time are also available for pickup. In Marfa, there is an additional separate voting station for the school district election. A $57 million bond proposal, which would raise property taxes in order to fund a new K-12 school and other campus-wide improvements. Marfa resident Elisa Vasquez, who wore a red, white, and blue I Voted Today sticker, turned up to vote early on Monday because she was going out of town, she said, adding that one of the local issues she was passionate about voting on was the school bond proposal. I wanted to early vote as soon as it opened to make sure that my vote is in, said Vasquez. I'm concerned about our school, the betterment for our students. I wanted to come and vote for that. Marfa resident Mia Valentini shared similar sentiments about checking voting off her to-do list before traveling. I just want to get it done, and hopefully if people see more people early voting, they'll get out and do it, said Valentini. Valentini said she chose not to participate in the school bond election because she didn't feel adequately informed or personally affected by the matter. There was so much opinion going on that it sort of passed me by a little bit, said Valentini. I don't have children in school. I'm out of school. So the effects it has on me seem a little less, except for my taxes going up. I didn't have as much of a personal attachment to it. She was, however, excited to cast her ballot for Presidio County Commissioner Precinct 4 candidate Democrat David Beebe and Texas Comptroller candidate Democrat Janet Dudding. Valentini said attending recent candidate meet and greets in the area helped bolster her understanding of the roles and influence of local government. Meeting and hearing some of the candidates really opened my eyes, actually, to what more local government involves. The federal government is so sensationalized that we forget that it's actually the local level that is far more important, said Valentini. Presidio County Treasurer candidate Republican David Chavez was reflecting on the democratic process and his motivations for running for the local position after casting his ballot. I like the idea of getting out there and making change when I think change is required, said Chavez. Chavez said, in general, it is important for citizens not to be complacent with their public officials, and more people need to be willing to put themselves out there and challenge unopposed candidates. We're all free to vote, and we're all free to run for office if we want to, he said. It's a tragedy, and it's also an insult to our society when you sit back and let things happen, and all you do is complain about it, but you don't jump in and try to do something yourself. Marfa residents Roger and Jean E. Amis, too, said exercising their constitutional right was a valuable way of expressing their opinions and getting involved. If you don't vote, you ain't got no right to bitch, said Roger. That's my take on it. The couple said one of their primary concerns on the state and federal level is the increasing numbers of migrants crossing the border illegally into the U.S., while one of the key local issues that brought them to the polls was the school bond, they said, which seemed like a big chunk of money to spend on a new K-12 school, considering the district is still paying off two existing bonds and is experiencing decreasing enrollment. We don't have the tax base for it, said Jean. We can't afford it. They got to fix up and make do. And besides that, it's not the campus that makes the students, it's the teachers. County Clerk Zubia said so far election operations were running smoothly, and she was curious to see what the voter turnout would be like on Saturday, October 29th, an additional date the Presidio Democratic Party petitioned to add to the voting calendar this election. Subia said in Presidio County there has been a decline in voters who choose to vote by mail, down to around 100 individuals from 200 in the pre-pandemic era. She encouraged residents to get out early to vote in case they encounter any complications. Since she first started working elections in 2007, she said, Election Day has always presented challenges. It seems that during Election Day, whatever scenario can happen will happen, said Zubia. Sometimes it just takes longer to try to figure out how the person can vote, or if they can vote in this county, or if they need to vote provisional. 6 years after tragic death of Marfa Teen struck by train, appeals court says Union Pacific not at fault. By Mary Cantrell, MKCANTRELL at BigBenSentinel.com. El Paso. An appeals court in El Paso last week ruled that Union Pacific is not legally liable for the tragic death of a Marfa teenager who, in 2016, was struck and killed by an oncoming train. The ruling brings an end to a years-long crusade by the child's grieving mother to hold the railroad company accountable for what she believes was negligence on its part. When 16-year-old Jason Molinar was struck from behind and killed by a Union Pacific train in Marfa while walking on the tracks with headphones on, his mother, Rosara Ariola, sued the company, alleging train operators failed to properly notify Molinar of the approaching train or to slow the train in a timely manner in order to prevent his death. A 2019 trial saw a jury find Molinar 90% at fault for his own death and Union Pacific only 10% at fault. The court entered a take-nothing judgment in the railroad company's favor, and Ariola was awarded no monetary damages. Ariola then appealed the court's decision on a number of grounds, including insufficient evidence, errors in evidentiary rulings, and improper jury counseling, which should have instructed the jurors to judge Molinar's negligence as a 16-year-old rather than an adult. Now, the Eighth Court of Appeals in El Paso has affirmed the earlier trial court's judgment, meaning the case is finalized unless Ariola chooses to appeal to the Texas Supreme Court. The 2019 trial proceedings, which took place in El Paso County Court, detailed how Molinar was walking to the Dairy Queen, holding his iPad with headphones on, when the train approached and struck him from behind. The train conductor at the time, Herbert Diaz, and engineer Bert Frederick Harkness, defendants in the suit, testified that they began blowing the train's horn to alert Molinar to move away from the tracks as soon as they recognized there was a person up ahead. When they realized he wasn't responding to the horn, they applied the emergency brakes, but it was too late, and Molinar was impacted 5 seconds later. In the suit, Ariola argued that Union Pacific failed to adequately train its employees as to how to respond to a person on the tracks. According to court documents, the train was carrying hazardous materials, traveling at a lawful speed, and routinely blowing its horn at various crossings through town. Train conductors testified that at the time they thought Molinar would turn around when he heard the train horn, and that they were concerned about a possible derailment caused by an abrupt stop, mainly because the train was carrying cargo that would have endangered the surrounding community. When the train crew spotted Molinar on the tracks, they could not see that he was wearing headphones, and they were therefore justified in assuming that he was in control of his faculties and would respond to the warning being given by the train's horn, claim court documents. But during the trial, Ariola argued for further scrutiny of the railroad company's equipment and procedures involved in the accident, including the train horn and binoculars utilized by crew members. A video presented at the trial included an audio which captured the sound of the horn blowing before and after the accident, according to court documents. Ultimately, both courts rejected Ariola's claims, a result the mother found disappointing. When reached for comment on the appeals court's ruling, Ariella said that the loss of her son continues to be a daily source of pain, and she was saddened by how court proceedings were handled, but grateful for those who remained close to her throughout the process. I am thankful for everyone that was there for my son in life and throughout the court proceedings. His family and friends in Marfa, Texas, were a great support throughout one of the hardest times for my family, said Ariola. I am thankful to the law firm that fought for my son's honor in court and the family that stood by our side through it all, she added. She said her son's favorite place to visit was the Presidio County Courthouse, where he liked to sit and draw, soaking in his surroundings. Many afternoons he would call me while he sat on a bench outside the courthouse and shared how happy he was, enjoying the simplicity of life in Marfa, said Ariola. Lawyers representing Union Pacific Railroad in this case did not respond to requests for comment by press time.
The Fort Stockton Pioneer, Thursday, October 27, 2022, read by Claire Noyes. Perkins sentenced to over 157 years in prison. On October 25th, Thomas Scott Perkins, 31, of Fort Stockton, was sentenced to 1,890 months in prison for distributing and possessing child sexual abuse material. According to court documents and evidence presented at trial, Homeland Security Investigations agents determined that Perkins was sharing child pornography online. A search warrant was executed at Perkins' residence, and multiple hard drive devices were discovered that contained 95,316 images and 1,237 videos of child pornography. On July 19, 2022, Perkins was found guilty by a federal jury sitting in Pecos of one count of distribution of child pornography and eight counts of possession of child pornography. Perkins has remained in federal custody since his arrest on September 14, 2022. Quote, the sentence demonstrates the horrors of this type of crime, which we will continue to relentlessly pursue, end quote, said U.S. Attorney Ashley C. Hoff. Quote, I want to express my deep gratitude to our law enforcement partners and dedicated prosecutors who work to bring this defendant to justice, end quote. Francisco Barola, special agent in charge of HSI El Paso, added, quote, this lengthy sentence is a testament to the repugnant nature of child exploitation crimes, particularly the production of child pornography, which only perpetuates the trauma endured by victims, end quote. HSI, with assistance from the FBI, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and the Texas Department of Public Safety, investigated the case. Assistant U.S. Attorneys Scott V. Greenbaum and Kevin Caton prosecuted the case. This case was brought as part of Project Safe Childhood, a nationwide initiative to combat the growing epidemic of child sexual exploitation and abuse launched in May 2006 by the Department of Justice. Led by U.S. Attorneys' offices and CEOs, Project Safe Childhood marshals federal, state, and local resources to better locate, apprehend, and prosecute individuals who exploit children via the Internet, as well as to identify and rescue victims. County Amends PCMH Budget by Sean Yorks. Pecos County Memorial Hospital made a request to the Pecos County Commissioner's Court on Monday morning, asking the county for $450,000 to be added to the operating budget. Chief Financial Officer Rebecca Ureta said two items have affected the hospital's cash, including an unexpected transfer of $500,000 that has not arrived. Quote, the net result of that payment for us would have been $500,000. That's substantial, end quote, Ureta said. Quote, so that is one thing that is most definitely impacting us being in a situation where we're having to request that, end quote. The additional funds make the budget even. Quote, we did request a reimbursement on something that we had paid for, but there was a little bit of a balance, approximately $58,000, and we would ask also that that be transferred to operating as well, end quote, Ureta added. The commission approved the request and declared an emergency to transfer the $450,000 this week and the $50,000 next quarter. Ureta also updated the commissioners on the flood damage the hospital received during a severe storm October 10th. Quote, currently we've been advised that we will probably need to do a 4-foot flood cut. So that would be 4 feet up all the way around the perimeter of the building, end quote, Ureta said. Quote, due to the extent of the damage in our lab, we're also going to have to probably look at doing a mobile unit to continue operation, end quote. She said the hospital has had different agencies evaluate and make sure, quote, everything is up to par, end quote, Ureta said, adding that the hospital is still waiting for the insurance adjusters. Quote, for patient safety, those are some of the things that have to happen when you have an event such as this one, end quote. City Council tweaks ordinances, seeks bid for Hodges Pavilion, by Sean Yorks. Fort Stockton residents will soon have a new reason to go to the Fort Stockton Convention Center. The Fort Stockton City Council on Monday night approved going out for bids for a new, quote, Hodges Pavilion, end quote, adjacent to the Convention Center near the entrance to Panther Pictures. The park will include a stage door for outdoor performances, an area for vendors, a dance floor, a gazebo, picnic tables, and restrooms. The venue will hold up to 1,000 people. City Manager Frank Rodriguez said the city has already gone out for requests for proposal for the restrooms at the park, which is the first phase of the project. Quote, in addition to that, we'll have exterior lights to accommodate the Hodges Pavilion area, end quote, Rodriguez said, adding that there will be 2 water features at the entrance. The council agreed to go out for request for proposals to begin the next phase of the project. Quote, the council approved Resolution 22-115R, which authorizes the city to file a grant application with the Texas Department of Agriculture for the Community Development Block grant for 2023 to 2024. This particular grant has identified a need to replace a sewer line at the Nunez Park off of Main Street, extending through James Rooney Park to include the addition of a lift station, end quote, Rodriguez said. Quote, the first step in order for us to secure a grant has to be a resolution by City Council authorizing us to pursue it. The Council approved Ordinance 22-130, changing the Tourism Advisory Board to 7 members, approved Ordinance 22-131, changing the Historical Landmark Commission from 11 to 9 members, and approved Ordinance 22-132, changing the Keep Historic Fort Stockton Beautiful Board to 9 members. The Council has approved a bid for janitorial services by Elfida Morales and Abiad Olivares. Morales bid $1,500 for City Hall and $500 for the City Hall Annex, and Olivares bid $1,000. Both clean City Hall as well as the Police Department and Police Dispatch, and the bids were the same as last year. The Council approved using American Rescue Plan funds to repair the aeration pond at the wastewater treatment plant, end quote. Coco and Dracula to be shown at FSCT. Fort Stockton Community Theater and Fort Stockton Film Society are joining forces to show 2 films through Halloween weekend at the Nelson Street Theater, 102 South Nelson. Disney's animated film Coco will be shown Saturday afternoon, October 29th at 2 p.m. and again Sunday afternoon, October 30th at 4 p.m. Coco celebrates the Mexican holiday Day of the Dead, which is on November 1st. The doors will open 30 minutes before the movie is to begin. There is no charge for admission, but donations will be welcome to help defray the licensing fee for the film. On Monday, October 31st at 7 p.m., the 1931 Spanish-language version of Dracula will be shown. Again, the doors will open 30 minutes prior to the show. There will be no admission fee, but donations will be welcomed. The Spanish version of Dracula was released in Havana, Cuba, in March 1931, and in New York City in April of that same year. In 2015, Dracula was selected for the United States National Film Registry by the Library of Congress. Make plans to attend showings of some of Hollywood's Halloween classics at the Nelson Street Theater on October 29th through 31st. County Commission approves changes to Buena Vista School Road closure in wake of May bond, by Sean Yorks. When Buena Vista Independent School District voters approved a $60 million bond last May, they were counting on a new building for classrooms and a cafeteria, improvements to the current facilities, drainage, a new playground, additional parking with new driveways, and traffic patterns, more teacher housing and upgraded ag areas, among other things. The Pecos County Commissioners Court on October 24th approved a critical step in the process. Quote, what we're doing is closing off the gap between the remaining building and the ag shop for student safety and security, end quote, Buena Vista ISD Superintendent Mason Kyle told the commissioners. Kyle said one of the first things he noticed when he came to the Imperial School last spring was the cars going back and forth through the parking lot as students were changing classes. When he spoke to the architectural firm, he asked if it could design something that connects everything. Quote, "The one hiccup in that is that Lincoln Street runs directly through the property," end quote, Kyle said, asking the commissioners to close Lincoln Street from the corner of Imperial Street. Quote, "That way we can combine these buildings, allow our kids more safe and secure access from the campus to the ag shop and back," end quote, Kyle said. Quote, "And also rerouting a road for our kiddos to be able to ride their bikes to cross over Highway 11 without having to touch 1053, end quote. Washington Street would be extended to the canal, and a water line would be rerouted as part of the bond package for infrastructure improvements. Santiago Cantu moved to approve the request with a second by Tom Chapman. Fall Cleanup Starts Monday by Nathan Huyer. Fort Stockton residents paying for city sanitation services will soon be able to get rid of select bulk items free of charge starting next week. The city of Fort Stockton will begin their annual fall cleanup on Monday, October 31st, and provide curbside pickup services. The community cleanup event will end on Thursday, November 10th. Residents are asked to call 432-336-8525 to schedule for pickup if possible. Bulk items that will be accepted include tree limbs, wood, scrap metal, furniture, small appliances, mattresses, carpet, and tires. Items must be separated before arrival and placed at the appropriate designated areas at the city landfill. Tires accepted must be whole and must not have rims on them. All loads must be covered. Items not accepted are junked vehicles, construction debris, oil filters, batteries, petroleum products and byproducts, explosive materials, medical waste, liquid waste, paint, refrigerators, washing machines, and stoves. The cleanup event is not for commercial customers or any other businesses. Due to the landfill waste acceptance limit set by TCEQ, each county precinct will be limited to 20 tons per day.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahans News for Thursday, October 20th. West Texas Barbecue Bash draws over 10,000. The story was written by Jan Cranfield. The third annual West Texas Barbecue Bash and Car Show saw 10,250 people come through the gate to enjoy a day of free food, drinks, music, car show, bouncy houses, and visiting with friends. 34 cooking teams from all over the state cooked a variety of foods for the public to sample and vote on as the best cooks. ARC Inspection with cook Aaron Cruz of Kennedy in the South Texas area was voted the best cooks, making them the Grand Champion Barbecue Bash title holders of West and South Texas. Raffle tickets for 5 firearms were sold during the day, with the winners being announced during the 6 p.m. drawing. Quote, "The first year of the barbecue bash, we had 5,200 people attend. The second year, 7,700 came. And this year, we have doubled the attendance," George Bunker, one of the event organizers, said. The full dollar totals for the Kids Zone donation amount was not final as of Monahan's News press time. The total from the car show going to the Kids Zone was $3,000. The date for the fourth annual West Texas Barbecue Bash and Car Show is already set for October 14, 2023, at the Ward County Arena. The South Texas Barbecue Bash will be in April of 2023. Quote, "This is our best year yet, and we look forward to an even better year in 2023, Bunker said. School does away with clear backpack policy. The story was written by Jan Cranfield. At the regularly scheduled Monahans Wicket Pyote ISD school board meeting held Monday evening, the Board of Trustees voted to change the student backpack requirements. School administrators rescinded the rule, and the new backpack policy took effect on Tuesday the 18th. The decision to change the policy came after a joint effort between local law enforcement and the school district. Quote, MWPISD works hand-in-hand with local law enforcement to provide the highest level of safety for students in the district, Ward County Sheriff Ferran Valle said. On September 19th, law enforcement officials provided a demonstration to school administrators of what can be carried or hidden in a clear backpack versus the same scenario with a solid color backpack proved the clear backpack was no safer than the solid one. Quote, after listening to parents, law enforcement, and the District Improvement Committee, MWPISD has decided to change its policy on mandating clear backpacks. We are doing this to give more control back to the parent and make it their decision on what kind of backpack to purchase, clear, not clear, bullet-resistant, etc. Student safety will always be our priority, and we don't just think that requiring clear backpacks is the answer when there are other backpacks that could be more helpful in the event of an active shooter, Superintendent of Schools Chad Smith said. In 2019, the clear backpack policy was one of several new safety improvements the district implemented with the passing of the 2019 bond under the tenure of former Superintendent Kelly Riley. In other actions, the principals and assistant principals were recognized by the Board of Trustees and given awards at the beginning of the meeting in recognition of National Principals Month. In another agenda item, the school board trustees approved the MHS choir trip to Corpus Christi. The choir trip will be booked through a travel agency in Midland. The trip is set for April 20th after the STAR testing is finished and scheduled to return on April 23rd. The next item was the approval of the budget amendment involving $900,000 moved from the general fund to building improvement fund. Quote, this is money that was approved in last year's budget that did not get used and would be used for the synthetic running track surface, said business manager Katie Jones. Quote, it was not used because of the delay in tearing down the field houses. We didn't want that mess scattered on the track surface, so it was postponed, Smith said. In a bond update, the concession stands have been supplied with water, and some minor leaks were discovered during the recent extensive rainfall. A date change for the scheduled November board meeting was approved. The date for the meeting was changed from November 24th to November 14th. Josh Schwab, Donna Garcia, Board President Raymond Reyes, Steve Tuxhorn, Nancy Epchurch, and Superintendent Chad Smith were present for the meeting, while Steve Fine and Bobby Almanza were absent. The next regularly scheduled board meeting will be on Monday, November 14th at 6:30 p.m. at the MWPISD Administration Building Boardroom, 606 South Betty Street. Shots fired call leads to one arrest. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. A shot fired call to law enforcement early Friday morning landed a Monahans man behind bars on two felony charges. According to Ward County Sheriff Ferran Valle, quote, deputies were dispatched to the 2300 block of West 2nd Street in reference to shots fired on October 14th around 7 a.m., end quote. During the investigation, deputies discovered the suspect, later identified as Abraham Bullis Cash, age 41, of 2310 West 2nd Street, shot a shotgun from his residence toward another residence in the area, Valle said. Cash was subsequently arrested and booked into the Ward County Jail and charged with deadly conduct, a third-degree felony. Deputies later learned Cash is a convicted felon, therefore he was also charged with unlawful possession of a firearm by a felon, a third-degree felony. Cash's bond was listed at $10,000 for each charge. He remains in custody in lieu of posting the $20,000 bond. The offense can be punishable by imprisonment in the Texas Department of Criminal Justice for any term of not more than 10 years or less than 2 years, and a fine not to exceed $10,000. Perch pond stocked with catfish Tuesday. Trout delivery set for mid-December. The city of Monahan's perch pond was stocked with 625 9-inch long channel catfish on Tuesday afternoon. The catfish came from the Possum Kingdom Fish Hatchery and was delivered by the Texas Parks and Wildlife. The city was forced to close Perch Pond for 2 weeks in July because of extremely low water levels, for an estimated 400-500 fish died due to lack of oxygen in the water. Monahan's had been experiencing extreme drought conditions, and Ward County had been mentioned as one of the driest counties in the state. Due to rainfall, the county's status has recently been elevated to abnormally dry. Over a 2-week period, the city pumped around 7 million gallons of water into the pond slowly to get water levels back to environmentally safe levels. City Manager Rex Thee said, quote, "The city purchases trout most years when the weather cools the pond enough to sustain them for the enjoyment of local fishing enthusiasts, and a delivery of 1,006 trout is scheduled for December 12th. End quote. There is no size limit for fishing trout in Perch Pond, but there is a limit of 5 fish per day, and a fishing license is required. Quote, "Occasionally, TX, P&W will stock other fish at different times to those locations that have been good stewards for their stocking programs. Monahan's Perch Pond was fortunate to be one of those," he added. Guests are reminded to please pick up their trash and help keep the pond area clean. Vigil planned Sunday to raise awareness of domestic violence. The second annual Domestic Violence Candlelight Vigil is slated to be held on Sunday, October 23rd, in recognition of October as Domestic Violence Awareness Month. This year's vigil will be held in memory of Latasha Thompson McPeak, who was murdered by her ex-husband on November 9, 2018, and in memory of Anna Elaine Ornelas, who was also murdered in a domestic incident on August 10, 1991. The annual event will begin at 2 p.m. on Sunday under the pavilion at the Ward County Event Center, located at 1525 East Monahan's Parkway. Organizer Destiny Rodriguez said, quote, "A memorial walk and balloon release will be held along with the candlelight vigil," end quote. Any donations of women's or kids' clothing or shoes are welcome and will be donated to the Crisis Center of West Texas in Odessa. T-shirts will also be sold for $20 each up until Thursday, so they can be worn at the vigil. Shirt proceeds will also go to the Crisis Center of West Texas. Anyone wanting to purchase a shirt or with questions about the vigil can call Rodriguez at 806-200-9264. Here is an obituary that appeared in the Monahan's News on Thursday, October 20th. Marcos A. Mendoza, known as Buddy, 58 years old of Pecos, passed away on October 17th in Odessa after battling pancreatic cancer 2.5 years. Marcos was born in Pecos to Magdaleno and Guadalupe Mendoza on March 5, 1964. He went to school in Pecos, graduated from Pecos High School in 1980. He was a longtime resident of Pecos. He was married 39 years to Hilda Mendoza and blessed with 3 children. He served over 25 years as a Pecos volunteer firefighter. He also served 2 years as a councilman for the town of Pecos City. He is preceded in death by his parents, Magdaleno and Guadalupe Mendoza. He is survived by his wife Hilda Mendoza, daughter Bianca Mendoza, sons Mark Mendoza, Magdaleno Mendoza, his brothers Ishmael Mendoza, Hector Tito Mendoza, His sisters, Florinda Natividad and Nellie Bowers, as well as several grandchildren. Visitation was held Thursday, October 20th, with the rosary recited at Pecos Funeral Home. Mass was celebrated on Friday, October 21st at 10 a.m. at Santa Rosa Catholic Church. Burial followed at Petrolio Cemetery. Arrangements are entrusted to Pecos Funeral Home. MEDC Board to seek bids for broadband internet provider. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. The Monahans Economic Development Corporation, the MEDC, board members met for their regularly scheduled monthly meeting on Monday afternoon, and after establishing a quorum, the board was first tasked with electing new officers. The board voted to elect Richard Irwin as president, Hal Upchurch as vice president, and Leticia Rodriguez as secretary. In other business, the board agreed to begin the process obtaining proposals for a internet service provider for the broadband project. Quote, the request for proposals will be sent to Delcom, Big Bend Telephone, AT&T, and Suddenlink, and we will go through the process. The proposal package includes performance and equipment specifications, Carol Faulkner with Faulkner Consulting told the board. Quote, I haven't found any interest from anyone here locally who would be willing to do that, so I feel one of these companies will be one we go with, he said. In other actions, the board tabled approving Monahans Parkway flume revision plans from Maverick Engineering, pending updated plans, and tabled obtaining bids to fence the detention pond on the south side of 12th Street, pending upcoming litigation. In regular business, the directors approved accounts payable for the month of August. Directors present were Richard Irwin, Hal Upchurch, Leticia Rodriguez, and Mary Elena Sines. Kathy Anthony was absent.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.